Happy Easter. Christ is alive. Jesus is risen. The grave is defeated. His love shines at Calvary. It's good to see you this morning. We're glad you're here. And especially if you're a guest hanging out with us this morning, we are so glad you chose to spend your Easter with us worshiping. Our prayer this morning is that event, while an event in history, will come to have great meaning for you today. And you'll realize that it's not just a story. It's something that really matters, and it really matters even to us today. There is hope. There is beauty. There is power. There is purpose. I mean, just everything in life can be found in understanding that God stepped into our story, and by living among us as in the person of Jesus, dying and rising again, it means everything for us today. And so that's kind of what we're going to be talking about. Have you been watching the Bible on the History Channel, the big thing? I mean, I see a few hands, which is kind of funny because it's like the number one miniseries of all time. Kind of amazing. They decided to do a series on the fact that the Bible is a story, right? Instead of a giant rule book, which if you grew up in church or if you didn't, you may have come to just kind of believe, hey, what the Bible is a giant rule book. It's God's rules for living. Well, really at the core of the Bible is a story. And so they came along and they said, okay, what we're going to do is we're going to make a mini series of the big story of the Bible. And they began with Noah, but Noah tells the story of creation and worked all the way through the Bible. Tonight's the climax is the resurrection and the spread of the church is going to be told. And I don't know how much of it you've watched. I haven't watched all of it. I've watched bits and pieces, have enjoyed most of it that I've seen. I do have one little qualm. Like they are telling the story of Jesus well, but I still am curious why every time somebody tries to portray Jesus with a video, that you have all these men, like Jesus called 12 men to follow him, right? And here's Jesus, the Son of God, calling 12 men to follow him. And Jesus teaches and Jesus preaches. He dies on the cross. I mean, that's kind of the big story here. Why is it that whenever they decide to picture this story, the person who plays Jesus is the only guy in the group that every guy looks at and goes, I can lick that dude. I don't know if you've seen, but you know, all these other men are manly men. They've got, you know, short things. They're fishermen. They're strong. And then here's Jesus. He's got curls, long flowing dress. I just don't get that part of it. It's kind of the 60s hippie Jesus, you know? You know, you can't expect Jesus to love everybody and then kind of go listen to the Grateful Dead after he's done kind of stuff. And while I think they're doing okay with the story, I'm not telling you don't watch the story of the Bible. It is interesting that that's kind of where people who try to picture the story, they run to for Jesus, which I don't think that's totally accurate. But the beauty of it is that there is, in the middle of this story, the big story of the Bible, and in the middle of the story of Jesus, the fact that he had put himself at odds with the Jewish religious leaders because of his teaching on the kingdom of God and on about grace. He put himself at odds with the Roman government as he made the claim that he was the true king of God's kingdom. And the outcome is that those two groups got together and decided to place Jesus on a cross, to crucify him, to lead Jesus through the most horrible form of execution humanity has ever devised for another human being. The cross was horrible. And this man dies on a cross, and you think, end of story. But 3 days later, that man is alive. He is physically alive. The Bible is very clear to try to tell us that this is not some ghost appearance. This is not some mysterious image of some guy who's like appearing in their dreams. That Jesus shows up. He eats fish with his disciples. He tells them to touch him, to feel his wounds. And this man who was beaten brutally and then crucified on a Roman cross, had nails driven through his hands, had nails driven through his feet, had a crown of thorns placed on his head, had a spear thrust through his side by a Roman soldier, had a Roman soldier stand at the foot of the cross and declare him dead. But as he declared him dead, as an executioner, said, behold, this man truly was the Son of God. They took him off a cross, they wrapped him in these cloths, and they put him in a tomb, which in ancient Israel would have been a rock like you saw in the video at the beginning of the service, and they left him there thinking, end of story. And 3 days later, this man is alive. He is appearing to people. He is inspiring beliefs. We call the tomb Joseph's borrowed tomb. I'm telling you that Jesus Christ is the only person in history who could ever borrow a tomb. And he is alive, and it makes all the difference in a world. Can you at least agree with me, if you're a skeptic, if you're unsure, can you at least agree with me this morning is that if that story happened, if a man died on a cross, 3 days later he is alive, and it's not some mystical resurrection, some mystical idea, but the man who physically was beaten to a pulp is alive. He's eating fish with his disciples, and his appearance inspires belief among the men and the women who follow him that if that event really happened, it matters. If that event really happened, that this Jesus, we need to take a good look at him. And so this morning, I just want to challenge you, if you're a skeptic, if you're somebody who's not sure, if you're kind of on the outside looking in going, man, maybe Christianity, I don't know, but the whole Jesus thing is like way beyond my understanding. I can't buy that a guy died and rose again. I want to let you know that's a good thing to be skeptical about. You and I do not go to our grandma's funeral and at our grandma's funeral make an appointment to have lunch 3 days later with her. We know that this is not normal. We know that this is out of the ordinary. But this changed. This event changed the world. And I will also tell you that this event has changed my life. And the question I'm trying to deal with this morning is not, did it happen? We've preached on that on Easter before. And there's a lot of good material. And if you have questions about that, I just want to let you know, I'll be hanging around after the service. We'll be doing baptism afterwards, but I'd love to chat with you. We have other people around who'd love to talk to you about how can I know? Did it really happen? How can I know? But this morning, what I want to say is, why does it matter? Because here we are 2,000 years later, and it's a story on the History Channel. It's an event on a Sunday morning where every church in the world is standing up with somebody like me, talking to a congregation saying, Jesus rose, he died and he rose. It's a big deal. I mean, that is great, but we come and then we go on with our lives tomorrow, and how does this event matter and why does it matter? If it's just a story a long time ago, that's great, man. Cool story. Guy rose again. Whoopee! Now what? This week, I went to Children's Hospital to visit one of our people. And one of our young men, I was having surgery. I went to the hospital. And I want to tell you that every time I go to that place, it wrecks me. I don't know if you've ever been to a children's wing of a hospital or a children's hospital like this. But as you're walking through, you're going to see things that in your mind, just they don't make sense. And while this young man had an effective surgery, and while every surgery is a big deal, his was not life-altering or life-threatening other than dealing with some things in his nose. But at that point in time, I was walking through the hospital, leaving, and I saw this man and this woman who were carrying this boy. He's probably about the age of my twins. And the boy was bald, and you could see that he was really weak and really frail. And Dad was gripping this boy, just holding on to him. And Mom's kind of guiding him by the hand, finding the elevator, trying to find a way to push open and close. They get in, but just without staring at the man, I looked into his eyes, and it wrecked me. It absolutely ruined me that day. Knowing the struggle and the pain, I mean, I had enough of the story without a word being told to go, God, this is where my greatest doubts are. God, this is the place where I go, I get it, I believe in you, but I don't get this elevator today, Jesus. And this event 2,000 years ago, people are standing in front of crowds saying it matters. The question is, does it matter? How does that story make sense there? or another family I know that went to bed and mom had to get up early and leave this last week or 2 weeks ago. She had to get up and leave and the kids were all around the house and the oldest kid's a young teenager with a couple younger brothers and sisters. And so dad stayed in bed and mom got up and they're around there. They're in their 40s. In fact, dad's 40 years old. And the youngest, the six-year-old goes in to wake up daddy. She can't get daddy awake. They send the 12-year-old to find their dad dead. He died in his sleep that mom didn't even know it when she left in the morning. And now this family has to deal with not only did dad pass away, but now their kids, this broken, horrible thing of fight. Does the cross, does this story matter? And we get up tomorrow morning and we go to Walmart and we go to our jobs and we deal with our kids and our kids have good days and bad days. And some days they just scream all day and you want to pull your hair out. And other days they're happy and you feel great. But it's so easy for this story just to find itself back into some mini series that's on TV and not the binding force of our lives. Does it really matter? And what happens in the Bible is the Bible starts and it tells this huge story. It begins with creation and it tells us that God made the first two people and those two people were created in the image of God to love God, to know God, to experience his fullness forever. But they made a heart decision and that heart decision was this. They didn't want a God, they wanted to be God. They wanted to rule their own lives and be at the center of their own universe. And instead of their lives revolving around the creator who created them, now their lives revolved around themselves. The outcome is total brokenness in every place in their life. And we live in a world that is massively affected at every turn by the brokenness of a creation that has creatures that were created in the image of God living with themselves as the center. Living as their own God, as their own king. And a God who still loves people. And what happens in the Old Testament story is that the Bible begins to tell this story of God calling this one guy out of this man named Abraham. And he makes a ton of promises to this man. And says, here's the deal. I'm going to bring you into a relationship, a covenant relationship. That's the word the Bible uses to describe it, covenant. Where God makes a ton of promises and says, I'm going to be faithful to keep these promises. I am now your God. You are my people. And he begins to create an image of what it looks like on the earth to have people with the true God as their God. And that man becomes a family. That family becomes a nation or a people. But those people are in slavery. And the book of Exodus begins to tell this story of this horrible, broken, wicked slavery as these people who are the descendants of Abraham, they are supposed to be God's people for several hundred years now, have been in an ethnocentric slavery that is just brutal, that is just terrible. They have a horrible taskmaster. And as they are in slavery, as they are in this situation, their lives are defined by two basic words. They are helpless and hopeless. There's no way they can remedy their condition. They cannot overthrow this wicked taskmaster. They cannot conquer this nation. They cannot do anything. They are in slavery and there's nothing they can do about it. They cannot overcome their situation. They cannot remedy their problem. And that has left them hopeless as they look forward in their lives. They have stories of a God way back there 400 years ago who spoke to some dude named Abraham, but they live their life today and they're going, I don't know how that matters in my life. Because today I'm a slave. And what happens in the story is that God acts on their behalf. And so here's what happens in the Bible. There are two places in the Bible where there are these huge stories that are the big stories that all the rest of the Bible is tied to. Everything in the Bible is connected to. The first story, the second in the Bible, but the first one I'll mention this morning is the one that we've been singing about. It is the cross. It is the story of Jesus coming, dying, rising again. But the second story, or the first one in order, is the story of the Exodus, where God steps into the story. He calls this man named Moses, raises him up, and tells him to go back to the king, to the Pharaoh, to look the Pharaoh in his eye and said, God is going to act. You have to let my people go to instill hope in the people. And God then acts. He sends these 10 amazing events that are called the 10 plagues, where God judges Pharaoh and the Egyptians while he is pouring his love into his own people. Eventually, those 10 plagues lead to the last plague, which is called where God sends the death angel and literally takes the life of the firstborn son of people in Egypt. But he delivers, he saves the Hebrews, the Jewish people, as he gives them this beautiful picture as they take the life of a lamb, and the blood then becomes a symbol on the doorposts of God's deliverance. And so they do this event. There's a celebration called the Passover, and the big story, the big result of this story is that God delivers them. They were helpless, but God rescues them from slavery. They were hopeless, but God gives them a new hope, and God loves them, and he takes them through this another amazing event where he literally parts the Red Sea. They cross on dry ground, and God has saved his people, and there is a celebration. There is a party. There is a joy because they were in slavery. Now they're free. They were hopeless, but now they have a hope. Their God was a distant image, but now God has acted. And the story leads from that point to this mountain called Sinai, where God brings his people and he is going to meet with them. He's acted for them, but they haven't really met him yet. And they're going to bring, God brings them to this mountain. And the crazy thing in the story is that the story begins with a man named Moses saying, how will I know that you're going to do this? And God says, here's the sign that I've acted. When you and the people come to this mountain, you'll know. Well, this is where the story goes. And we're going to look at this, this story of God bringing his people. He has now acted on their path. He's going to bring the people to himself. And so if you have a Bible, grab your Bible and turn to Exodus chapter 19. If you don't have a Bible in your rows, we have Bibles for you. We want you to have one of those Bibles. We want you to read along with us. I'm going to read it, and then I'm going to talk a little bit about it this morning, explain what this passage means and how this explains to us a rhythm in the Bible that if you understand what the Bible's teaching here and that you see how the Bible teaches this about the cross, it can and change everything. It will make all the difference in the world if you trust it. So, chapter 19. We'll be up page 52 in those Bibles. There's Bibles, like I said, at the end of your row. Take one of those, pass it down, make sure everybody has one. And if you don't have a Bible at home or you have friends who need a Bible, feel free to take those. And we put a brand new case of Bibles out this morning because we've been giving Bibles away. That excites us. And so we'd love for you to have that as our gift to you this morning. Exodus chapter 19, I'm going to read this real quick to you, and then we're going to talk about the meaning here and what it's pointing us to. It says, and on the third new moon, after the people of Israel have gone out of the land of Egypt, or in other words, it's been 3 months since this great event where God delivered them from slavery, parted the sea, this huge event where God has rescued his people. It's now been 3 months. They'd gone out from the land of Egypt on the day they came into the wilderness of Sinai. They set out from Rephaim and came into the wilderness of Sinai, and they encamped in the wilderness. There, Israel encamped before the mountains. And while Moses went up to God, the Lord called him out of the mountain, saying, thus you shall say to the house of Jacob and tell the people of Israel, you yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians, how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now, therefore, if you indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, you will be my treasured possession among all the peoples, for all the earth is mine, and you will be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words that you speak, you shall speak to the people of Israel. God calls Moses to the mountain. He says, I want you to go talk to my people. I want you to go tell them this. And he gives them something that changes everything. And so this morning, what I want to talk to you is I want to talk to you about math. You expected me to say I want to talk to you about theology. Nope, I want to talk to you about math. And here's a little precursor. I am terrible at math. We have a math teacher in our congregation, and we've had this conversation before where, to be honest with you, I'm not really sure why people have to go to math class. We have computers now, right? Calculators. And she tells me, no, it's important. My sister listens to my sermons, and next week she's going to call me. She's going to be a little bit upset because I said this, because she's also a math teacher. And this whole math thing, like, I had to work really hard, and I just never really got the point. I was the kid who was sitting in math class going, why does this matter? How am I going to use this in the rest of my life, right? You had that. Some of you had that in English class. You loved the math class. You had it in English. Some of you had it in history. I loved history. I think history matters for everybody, but math not so much. And so, math is this hard thing for me. I guarantee you, if I am trying to do the books or anything, I have to have somebody to double check for me because I'm not good at math. And believe it or not, my oldest son got my genetics. I'll be done listening to this, but I will tell you that he is working on freshman algebra, college algebra for the third time. And so he has my math skills, or lack thereof. Math is not something that I often think matters, but today I want to let you know that math matters. I want to tell you a math problem that if you understand this math problem, it will change your life. It's not a hard one. It's actually just a sequential number thing, okay? And it goes like this, and I hope that when you leave here, you will have this memorized, like you even put a poster on your door that has this math problem, because I hope it sinks deep in you. I hope you go, math, it really matters. At least it really matters today. And here's the math equation, all right? You ready? Here's the math equation. It's really, it's not hard, but it may take a little bit for it to sink in. Are you ready? 19 comes before 20. That's it. That's the math equation. You got it? Everybody say it together with me. 19 comes before 20. Now, remember that, okay? I think I did learn that one probably in second grade math. I didn't realize it was this important at the time, but I did learn 19 comes before 20 when I learned to count. Or maybe for me it was more like fourth grade, but don't tell anybody that, okay? 19 comes before 20. You got to say it again with me. 19 comes before 20. You're like, have you lost your mind? Yeah, but that's beside the point, okay? What I want to do is there is a rhythm in this story where God, he has rescued them. He has brought them to himself. And now they are at this mountain. They are afraid of God. They don't want to go up to see God. They're like, Moses, you just go for us. And Moses is like, okay, I'll go up. And they're cowering at the mountain. But Moses goes up the mountain and he's talking to God. And God says, Moses, go down and tell them this. And what God tells Moses to go down and tell his people is the next seven chapters of Exodus. But it begins with chapter 19, okay? And this is what's called the covenant at Sinai, or the covenant with Moses and the Hebrews. In other words, just like God made a covenant filled with promises to Abraham, where he said, I'm gonna be your God, you're gonna be my boy, I'm gonna make a great family from you. Now he is going to look at this nation that he has saved and say, here's the deal. I am now going to enter into a relationship with you. I'm gonna to pour my love. I'm gonna make a ton of promises. I will be your God. You are now my people. And there is a rhythm, and the rhythm, 19 comes before 20, is the rhythm of the entire Bible. Everywhere we're reading the Bible, once you, if you catch this morning, if you leave here understanding this, it will literally, I hope it revolutionizes the way you even read the Bible. 19 comes before 20. So I got to explain what I'm talking about, because I know you're like, dude, you've lost me like way back then. You know, the math teacher's probably going, I'm good at math, and I don't even know what the heck you're talking about. So here we go, chapter 20, which we'll deal with in more detail in 2 weeks, is the Ten Commandments. Thou shalt not, thou shalt, this is what I, this is how you live. And we hear, you know, maybe some of us have heard the Ten Commandments, maybe some of us have heard the discussion of whether or not they should be in courtroom walls. We've heard all this story, and we think, oh, there it is, there's God. Ginormous bunch of rules. He's a big rule making, we gotta fire the rule, whipping the whip, telling us, this is how you live. I'm God. And we go there and we see chapter 20 is all about rules. And we go, that's it. I knew it. I knew that. See, I come to church. You're going to tell me I got to keep the list. I got to do the rules. I got to make my life a certain way. And if I there's a good God. That good God likes good people. And so maybe I'll try to be a good person. So what's the list? Just give me the list. And chapter 20 is where God says, this is how you will live. But chapter 19 is everything. And it's before chapter 20. And what we have in chapter 19 is what Bible scholars, people who read the Bible, called the eagle wing speech. Before God gives the law, before God does anything with the people, teaching them how to live, he says, Moses, go down and you be the one who's the mediator, who's the spokesman, and tell them this. And the rhythm of 19 before 20 is everything of understanding why the cross matters today. So let me show this to you and explain it to you, because there is a rhythm that is set forth here that is actually the rhythm everywhere you go to the Bible, everywhere you go. And the cross is the second big event that forms this rhythm again. So watch this. Verse 3. He says, while Moses went up to God, the Lord called to him out of the mountain, saying, thus you shall say to the house of Jacob and tell the people of Israel. Verse 4, you yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself, is what he says. He says, you saw it. You saw me work on your behalf. You saw what I did to the Egyptians. You saw how Moses spoke to Pharaoh. You saw the plagues. You saw the sea open. You put the blood on your doorposts. You saw your children saved. And even though you didn't deserve better, I have rescued you. And here's the big idea. The first part of this huge rhythm is this story of redemption. That the Bible rhythm always begins with redemption. In other words, God says, I have acted on your behalf. I have stepped into your story. And when you were hopeless, when you were helpless, when you had nothing you could do to remedy your situation, when you had nothing to live for, I stepped into your story and I saved you. Not because of anything you had done, not because you deserved it, and not because you could help me do it. I just did it to display my glory and for your good. I have redeemed you. And he says, look at this. You saw that happen for the rest of the Bible, especially the Old Testament. If you start reading the Old Testament, you will find that almost every passage where God begins to speak to his people for the next 1500 years, this is the way the passages are going to open. You are my people. I have saved you from slavery in Egypt and made you a people for myself. This event for the entire story of the Old Testament is the pin that their lives are tied to. Who are they? They're the people that God rescued. You're like, but that was 20 generations ago. Yes, but our identity is still wrapped up in we are the people that God rescued. He has saved us. If God hadn't acted, we would still be in Egypt today. Redemption. And then look what he says. And he says, I've borne you on eagle's wings. I don't know if you're a fan of eagles. I love eagles. I mean, there's not many places where I go where if there's an eagle, I don't want to go look at it. We were at the zoo a couple weeks ago, eagle in a cage, you stop and look at it. But my most enjoyable times watching eagles have been when I've been up around Alton during the eagle migration. I'm a hunter, and there have been a couple times where I've been hunting around there, waterfowl hunting, where we've literally had eagles hit the water and catch fish 20 feet from us. And to watch these birds fly is amazing. They don't fly like a duck. They don't fly like a hummingbird. Hummingbirds, you know, just this. And I love hummingbirds too. I love watching them. But man, the effort, I just sit there and go, how do they keep it up? And if you know a hummingbird, the reason you put a hummingbird feeder out is because they need so much energy to keep those little wings going, because it's all about them beating their wings to make it happen. But an eagle flies differently. An eagle flies differently. This is why an eagle flies. And what happens is that when an eagle spreads his wings, there are heat currents. As the sun warms the earth, air is rising, and an eagle just throws its wings out and catches the current and glides. No effort. No effort. And here's what God says to his people. In Egypt, you were beating your wing like a hummingbird. It got you nowhere. but I've borne you in eagle's wings. You couldn't save yourself, and there was no effort you could brought to this, but I just spread your wings out, and you soared. And the first part of this rhythm is always redemption. But then look at what he says. He says, and I brought you to this mountain. Is that what he says? Those of you who are looking at me, look down. What does it say? And I brought you to myself. Now, see, most of you didn't flinch when I said that because you expected, well, yeah, that's what it says. I brought you to this mountain. That's not what he says. He didn't say, I brought you to this mountain. He said, I brought you to me. I brought you to me. I brought you to myself. The reason I saved you is that I want a relationship with you. I want to pour myself into you, and I want you to know me. I want to know you. I brought you to me. The second part of this rhythm, 19 comes before 20, is this, that there is relationship, that God has acted, and now he has brought people to himself, and he forms them as a people. But the key to who they are as a people is that he has rescued them, and he has brought them to himself. And God has acted on their behalf. And now at the mountain, he says, I've brought you to me. I've rescued you and I've brought you to myself. And he goes, and you are going to be a treasure possession. He says, all the earth is mine. Look at it in the text. He says, all the earth is mine, but you are mine in a different way. Now that's important, this morning. Because the God who is, you need to realize that if you're here this morning and you don't know Jesus, you don't believe in God, you don't hold to him, that does not change the fact that he is the sovereign creator. You are his. But what he does is in the Old Testament, he forms a people that are a special, a treasured possession for himself. They're his personal treasure. Everybody's his, they are his in a different way. And they are his in a way that he is going to pour himself into them. He is going to transform them. And he is going to be, they are going to be his treasured possession. Now, the beauty of the gospel is that when you meet Jesus, he becomes your treasured possession. But I love, as God says here to his people, you are my treasured possession. And he says, I have brought you into relationship with myself. And then he goes on to use this beautiful language where he talks about them being a kingdom of priests, a holy nation, this treasured possession. In other words, here's what God is doing. As he brings them into a relationship with himself, they will know God. They will have a relationship with God. They will be intimate with God. He's going to act on their behalf and live among them. And the outcome is that there will be a people on this planet who have a different God. They live with a different king. And therefore, their lives are different because they have a different God, different king. And then the world will look and go, they do life, they do sex, they do parenting, they do idolatry. I mean, they don't do idolatry, they do their gods. Everything about their lives is different because they have a different God. And he says, this is what's going to happen. You will represent me to the world because you are in a relationship with me. And so there's this God says, I've rescued you, I've brought you to myself, and now the third part is rules. You're like, I knew it, there's rules. But watch this. All the rules are is God, as he loves his people, as he has already rescued them, he's already done that. He has already brought them to himself, saying, now, because I'm your God, this is the way you live your life. You live differently because you have a different God. That's what the rules are all about. What sometimes Christians, and I will say that I don't care whether or not the Ten Commandments are on a courtroom wall or not. Hear that. So if you think that's a good idea, great. If you don't think it's a good idea, don't. This is not my point. The Ten Commandments were not written for a world who doesn't know God. They were given to a people who had already been rescued by God and brought to God in relationship with God. And now God says, because I've acted and I've brought you to me, here's how you live. And oh, by the way, I'll be responsible for the transformation in your heart to make this happen. And so the rhythm all through the Bible, everywhere you go, it doesn't matter where you land, is this. Redemption. God has acted. He has rescued us. Relationship. He has brought us to himself. Rules. This is how you live. You read any New Testament book, that's the order of it. Book of Romans. Great book on theology. This is what God has done. He has brought you to us to himself. This is how we live. Book of Ephesians. This is what God has done. He has rescued us from slavery. This is he has brought us to himself. By the way, this is what it looks like to live with Jesus at the center of our lives. Everywhere in the Bible, this is the order. But here's the problem. Here's the problem. Many of us grew up in traditions. We've grown up in churches. We've grown up in religious ideas. We've been in a home where our grandma taught us a whole bunch of stuff about the Ten Commandments. And we kind of learned a religious system that took this order and flipped it completely upside down. And we've lived our whole lives this way. There is a God. He's a good God. That good God loves good people. I'm going to be a good person. And so what we did is we said, I have to keep the rules. I have to figure out the system. I have to figure out what it is. What do I have to do for God to like me? And I try to keep the rules. I try to do all the good stuff. And as I do all the good stuff, then maybe God will be okay with me. And maybe he'll save me. And we've turned it upside down, and we've turned this beautiful story of the cross and resurrection into Jesus died for you, now buck it up and live better. Jesus died for you, now be a rule keeper. Jesus died for you, now be a good person, earn what Jesus did for you. And I wanna let you know, you can't earn it. The Hebrew people could not earn their rescue, they could not remedy their situation. You and I are in the same situation. We are slaves to sin, slaves to death. We can't do anything to rescue ourselves. And the Bible keeps shouting out to us a simple math equation. 19 comes before 20. 19 comes before 20. Redemption, relationship, then rules. And this is, for many of us, our frustration with church with Jesus has been we thought it was all about a list I'm supposed to keep. And every religious system creates a list. Doesn't matter how you grew up. It doesn't matter if your church talked about Jesus. The tendency is that there were at least some who spun it into a list. In the church I grew up, it's you don't drink, you don't chew, you don't cuss, you don't play pool. That's one of the weirder things. Like, there was this one, I'm not making this story up, there's one point in time where a family in church tried to donate a pool table to the youth ministry that I was leading. The deacons told us no, we couldn't have a pool table, because if they start playing pool in the basement of church, they might go to the pool hall. If they go to the pool hall, they might start drinking. If they start drinking, they might hang out with the wrong girls to get her pregnant, and that all started because we had a pool table at church. I was like, listen, dude, let me tell you, you pull the pool table out, they can still pull all that off, you know. And so the crazy thing is, in this religious system, are you ready? The pastor took the pool table and put it in his home. Do you see the craziness of how religion twists this? And the gospel says it's not about rules. Do not make a dedication this morning to follow the rules of God. Run to the place where God has provided rescue. And that's the gospel. And so what happens is we respond to this in one of two ways. We will say, I'm saved through rules. So I'm going to keep the list. Whatever my church is, my religious system says, here's the list I got to do. I will keep those rules. I will follow this system. And if I follow the system good enough, God will like me. And if God likes me, maybe he'll save me. Or we just chuck it and go, instead of being saved through rules, I'm going to be saved from rules. I'm just going to go. I'm going to live my life however I want to. If there is a God, he's got to be okay with me. He's going to have to affirm me, because I'm going to live my life the way I want to. And in the middle of this, in the Old Testament, there is a story of rescue. And then we run to the New Testament. There is a story of rescue. And we are slaves to sin. We are slaves to death. Our lives are defined by men holding childs who are suffering, and people who have addictions they can't overcome, and our own internal struggle and doubts, and the fact that we know somewhere out there in the distant is a downhill slide towards a day where my life will end, and all this defines us, all this binds us, and if we get trapped in that, if we just live in that, we are helpless. We can't remedy our condition. We can't save ourselves. We are hopeless. There's nothing we can do to have hope in this world, and in the midst of this, Jesus steps into the story. He lives the life I should have lived, and then he dies on the cross, and he pays the price for our rescue. And 3 days later, He walks out of the grave, providing hope. And just like the people of the Old Testament, for those of us who know Jesus, there's this continued calling out to go, I know sometimes it's hard. Sometimes you feel abandoned. Sometimes you feel alone. Sometimes you can't make sense. But I have rescued you. I've brought you to myself, and I'm changing your life. Just hold on to Jesus. And for those of us who don't know Jesus, there is this cry that says, God has done everything to act on your behalf. He has provided rescue. He has provided a path to this. And so the New Testament talks about the cross with a few passages. Colossians 1, 12 to 14 says this, giving thanks to the Father who has qualified you to share in the inheritance of the saints in light. He has delivered us from the domain of darkness and transferred us to the kingdom of his beloved Son, in whom we have redemption, the forgiveness of sins. You hear that? He has delivered us from darkness into light. How? By dying on the cross and rising again, he has provided redemption. 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verses 18 and 19 says, all this is from God who through Christ reconciled us to himself and gave us the ministry of reconciliation. That is, in Christ, God was reconciling the world to himself, not counting their trespasses against them, and entrusting to us the message of reconciliation. Do you hear that? Here's what Jesus did on the cross. He has rescued us. He's provided the path to redemption. He has paid it all. We couldn't save ourselves. He has provided the path to that. He has opened the door to reconciliation with God. In other words, he has brought people back to God. He is forming a people. And this is what he says. And God said through a man named Peter in 2 Peter, you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for his own possession, that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. And hear this. This is the gospel. The good news of Jesus Christ is this, that we are slaves. We are helpless. We are hopeless. We cannot get out of our situation. We cannot remedy our problem, but Christ has come. God has acted on your behalf. He has loved you. He has paid the price for your redemption. He has opened the path to know God. He has brought those of us who know him to himself. And from that position of being rescued, from that position of knowing God, he will change your life. And that's the hope of Easter. And that is why today I can stand up and say that event happened, but here it is 2,000 years later. It makes all the difference in the world to me. I am not living my life trying to please a God who is distant. I'm being transformed by a God who has rescued me and loved me, not because of me, but in spite of me. Glory be to God. That is the gospel. Amen.